King, Reel Number 1. Mr. King, you joined the Royal Flying Corps in 1913. What were you doing before you joined up?
Well, originally I was apprentice to a wheelwrights and coach builders business in the country. And after I'd come through my apprenticeship, I came to London. I did roughly a year's work as improver, but conditions were very different. I worked in a workshop which was partially underground, and the whole thing was very depressing, and I wanted to get into a more open-air life, and I cast about to see what I would do. And one day when I was walking in Kingston, I met two fellows. They were soldiers with an unusual badge on their shoulders. They had the letters RFC on the shoulder. And I got into conversation with them, and they told me they were members of the new regiment called the Royal Flying Corps, which had just started. And why didn't I join? And I talked about that with them, through them.
Did you actually stop them in the street and ask them who they were and what these badges represented?
Well, I really don't know how. You know how you get in touch with a girl, it was something like the same. You just don't know, you just look at each other and you start talking. Anyway, they talked to me in a very convincing way, and when I got back the next day to work in the shop and look around the shop, I really longed to do something like they did.
Can I ask you, had you heard of the Royal Flying Corps before this meeting?
No.
So it didn't mean anything at all to you until you met these two soldiers?
I was very interested in flying, Bleriot crossing the Channel and so on and so forth, but I didn't know that there was any military regiment concerned with flying at all. I didn't know anything about that.
Had you had any other acquaintance with flying? What did you know about flying at that time? What kind of impression did flying make on you in those days? How did you regard it?
Well, strangely enough, I didn't bother about the flying. I knew it would be a very open-air life, out in the air and on big open fields. And in 1911, I had seen someone fly at Hendon, Gustav Hamel, I think it was, who flew it on the Hendon Aerodrome, and I had a... That was all I knew about flying. I just saw him fly around the aerodrome and also a Captain Fox on a military biplane, as they called it. But beyond that, I had no knowledge of flying or the Royal Flying Corps at all.
Mm. Could you describe that experience in 1911 at Hendon? Tell me what Hendon was like, and tell me what the gathering was like and what its atmosphere was like.
Well, it was advertised they would be flying to see an aeroplane down there, and there was a usual crowd. Well, I think we paid something at the gate and went in. And these aeroplanes flew from one corner of the field just about over the people's heads and did a demonstration flying round. And one funny thing was happened that the announcer said... This is Gustav Hamel on a aeroplane with a gnome engine. And the crowd thought he said, no engine. And there was quite a joke about that. But it was a gnome, you know, G-N-O-M-E, a gnome engine. Anyway, he flew round and did a few demonstrations at perhaps 100 feet up. And then a Captain Fox brought out a biplane. And he flew round and he flew away. And it's quite a short demonstration. We weren't there very long, but everyone was very interested because most of us had never seen an aircraft in the air before.
Did it attract a lot of people, Hendon, for these meetings?
Oh, yes, I suppose there'd be 400 or 500 there. I can't remember exactly whether it was advertised much, but they are the facts. There was quite a good crowd there, and...
What
and
was,
that's all that happened.
What was Hendon like? Could you describe Hendon as you recall it in 1911?
No, I can't.
Okay.
I think Hendon Aerodrome was then pretty much like it is now, except there weren't so many buildings around about. Hmm.
Okay, can we move back to 1913? What happened after you'd met these two members of the Royal Flying Corps? What did you do?
Well, after I left them, I did ask them a few things what I should do if I did decide to join up. And so I went round to the nearest recruiting sergeant and asked him about it. And he said, yes, I think there is something starting like that. And if you'd like to join, I'll find out for you. I carried on with my work, and later on I called in there, and he'd found out a little bit about the Royal Flying Corps, but not very much. So I decided I would go a bit further with it. And I went to Kingston Barracks and made my final decision. That was the depot of the East Surrey Regiment. And I was sworn into the army there, but not specifically to the Royal Flying Corps. I suppose they could have put me in any other unit, but I expressed a desire I wanted to go in the Royal Flying Corps. So I was given a railway warrant and sent down to Aldershot. And when I got there, I asked the first serviceman I saw, where are the barracks of the Royal Flying Corps? They said, Royal Flying Corps? I've never heard of it. But after a while, I asked some more, and they said, well, it's in North Camp. It's rather a long way from here. And by inquiring once or twice more, I finally found that the Royal Flying Corps at that time, they shared barracks with the Black Watch, that's the 42nd Royal Highlanders, and Malplaquet Barracks, and also with the Munster Fusiliers in Oudenarde Barracks. So I reported there. And from there I was sent up to a small building on the actual aerodrome at Farnborough. And then all the further particulars of my enlistment were taken down. And I was sent back to the barracks for my first night in barracks. And having been sworn in, that sort of thing, and I was still in civilian clothes, but I went back to barracks and was given a bed. And in one of these barrack rooms, which are spare from these infantry regiments, and so I spent my first night in barracks. And when I woke up in the morning, I heard the trumpets from the south camp, that was the cavalry, and the bugles from the north camp. I was delighted. I thought, well, I'm really, truly in the army at last, you know. And that was my first awakening.
Yeah. This was at Farnborough.
Yeah, this was at Farnborough, yes. Or shall we say, Aldershot. Uh-huh. It was almost all one, you know.
Yes.
But there were no barracks in Farnborough itself. This was in North Camp, Aldershot.
I see. So the barracks were in Aldershot.
Yes.
And presumably most of the... Could you explain to me the way in which your time was divided between Aldershot and Farnborough?
Well, in the first day or two, we spent nearly all the time in drill, every kind of drill, on the square at Aldershot. And these squares were adjacent to the infantry barracks. I think it was the square on Oudenarde Barracks we actually drilled. We drilled the ordinary infantry drill, stick drill and things like that, because at that time every soldier had to carry a stick, as you know. And we learned parts of King's Regulations.
Sorry to interrupt you, but I didn't know that every soldier had to carry a stick. Why was that?
Well, every soldier carried a stick with his regimental number stamped on the little brass... the brass.
I didn't realise that all soldiers had to carry a stick. Why was that?
Every soldier carried a stick. Ours was a little short cane with the regimental crest on the top. And cavalrymen carried a whip without a thong. The idea was to, I think, was to keep you from walking with your hands in your pockets. But the drill concerning the stick was quite precise. If you were walking along, you carried the trail. That is to say, you held it in the middle, and it was in a horizontal position with the ground as you marched along. And if you stop for any reason, you brought your right hand smartly across your chest and tucked it in under your left armpit like that to stand still in the position of attention. Or if you were saluting officers, for instance, or any kind of salute, you put the cane underneath your left arm like that, leaving your right hand free. And if you were going along and you saw a civilian funeral, you had to salute that. If it was a military funeral, you had to stop and face it and salute it. And all these instructions are very precise. And the wearing of a cap, for instance, you were taught that you never took your cap off in any circumstances, unless if you were visiting someone and you were asked into the house, then you took your cap off. If you met a lady, you never took your cap off. You just bowed or gave some kind of a salute, but you wouldn't take your cap off. That was a thing that you only done under exceptional circumstances. And they were all the little details that we had to learn. And polishing shoes, we were never allowed to use patent polish. It had to be blacking. You had this tin of blacking and you spat in the tin and cleaned your shoes with that. And that, I think, is how we came about the idea of the word spit and polish. And we cleaned our shoes with that old-fashioned method, and it was compulsory. If you had patent polish on your shoes, the instructor would spot it at once and there'd be trouble. And in between all the usual drills, we had bits of King's regulations read out to us. And one thing was the some kind of act, I just forget what it was called, whereby the... Oh dear, let's stop it a minute.
Okay.
Well, we were all assembled on parade, and the warrant officer in charge read out this military act, and it was the punishment awarded.
Oh, right.
This act was read out to us and gave instances of punishment to soldiers who committed any serious crime, such as striking an officer or being drunk in the face of the enemy, or making any noise during an attack so as to attract the attention of the enemy. And as each clause was read out to us, it ended up in this way: death, or such less punishment as in that act mentioned. And that came as a kind of a refrain after every clause: death, or such less punishment as in this act mentioned. And of course, we all took it very seriously, and we were quite understood that we would be shot. That naturally enough, if we did these things as enumerated in this act, we would be shot. And I don't think anyone thought there was any hardship in being threatened by death if we made such awful crimes as mentioned in that.
So tell me a bit more about what went on at Aldershot when you first went there, and how you divided your time between Aldershot and Farnborough.
Well, I'm still in Aldershot now. Now, everything during the day was sounded by bugle call. Reveille to start with, and then on parade and no parade, letters and dinner call, and all these different calls went right throughout the day. So you only had to listen, and you knew what was going on. But each regiment in Aldershot had a signature tune, so to speak. They blew something on the bugle, which was a preliminary, telling the men that was for their particular regiment. As you can see, that the bugle calls did sounded all over the place amongst different regiments, and the same call didn't apply. Therefore, they had what you might call a signature tune. And when the men of that regiment heard their signature tune, they picked up their ears, and they knew that there was a parade, or whatever it was. And this went on right throughout the day, till the very last call was lights out. That was an interesting point about it. Well, after some time of purely soldiers training, we were taken up to the aerodrome in Farnborough.